भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय श्रीमद् भागवतम् फिफ्थ कैंटो चैप्टर फाइव लॉर्ड Rishabhadev's teachings, text 32. When Lord Rishabhadev saw that the general populace was very antagonistic to his execution of mystic yoga, he accepted the behavior of a python in order to counteract their opposition. Thus he stayed in one place and lay down. While lying down, he ate and drank, and he passed stool and urine and rolled in it. Indeed, he smeared his whole body with his own stool and urine so that opposing elements might not come and disturb him. Purport. According to one's destiny, one enjoys allotted happiness and distress, even though one keeps himself in one place. This is the injunction of the Shastras. When one is spiritually situated, he may stay in one place, and all his necessities will be supplied by the arrangement of the Supreme Controller. Unless one is a preacher, there is no need to travel all over the world. A person can stay in one place and execute devotional service suitably according to time and circumstances. When Rishabhadev saw that he was simply being disturbed by traveling throughout the world, he decided to lie down in one place like a python. Thus he ate, drank, and he passed stool and urine and smeared his body with them so that people would not disturb him. As you recall, those who have been here in morning class, Lord Rishabhadev's behavior as an avadut, paramahansa, beyond all Vedic rules and regulations, his behavior began at home. After he finished instructing his 100 sons, in other words, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as an ideal grihastha, is demonstrating the father's obligation not only to pass down money, but more importantly, to pass down spiritual instruction. Therefore, when Lord Rishabhadev saw that his sons had indeed been sufficiently educated in Divya Gyan, the divine knowledge of the Absolute Truth, at that point, in his own home, he adopted the behavior of a madman. Disheveled hair, naked, just acting completely contrary to social convention while living at home. The purports explain, as you remember, that Lord Rishabhadev's education that he imparted to his sons was actually not completely meant for them because they were already sufficiently spiritually equipped. Actually, Lord Rishabhadev is teaching all future sannyasis what is the nature of material existence. These instructions by Lord Rishabhadev were lectured upon by Srila Prabhupada a few times. They get to the core of material attachment in a very sometimes powerfully direct way that may frighten you. Just like the activities of Rishabhadev that we're reading now, they may seem very frightening. Lying down, passing stool and urine, rolling in it, smearing the whole body with his own stool and urine so that people will not bother him. This can put you off. You could be very standoffish about this. Similarly, you can be very standoffish, put off by Lord Rishabhdev's instructions, because they just grab the hard knot of material existence and chop at it. You may not like this. People can often be very sensitive about their material attachments. So the job of a preacher is always to understand when to assuage and when to chop, when to pacify the person and when to directly administer the medicine. This kind of sensitivity is what makes distributing Krishna consciousness so fascinating. You're always reading the pulse of the patient, and you're seeing when is the opportune time to give the medicine. You know that in the sixth canto, who is it? Narada Muni and Angira Rishi. They approached Chitraketu. They saw that he wanted something. So, upon inquiry, they learned Chitraketu was feeling so depressed he had no son. So they gave him a benediction that he could have a son. Then when that son died and plunged the whole palace, the whole city in lamentation, Narada Muni and Angira Rishi, they came back again and they told him, the first time we were here, we could have given you transcendental knowledge, but you were so attached. So we just let you have a son and let things proceed in their due course. What is the due course in material existence? Sooner or later you're going to lament. It's just a question of time. You are lamenting after 5 minutes, that person is lamenting after 15 minutes. The one who's lamenting after 15 minutes thinks, my life is superior. You were lamenting at 5 years old. I lamented at 30 years old. Therefore, my life is so much better. It is a great art how to speak, to inspire persons to take up the devotional service of the Lord. Sometimes you may think that, is it my mistake if I speak too directly? If I say something in a way that later I realize I could have impressed that person with Krishna consciousness in a different way? Srila Prabhupada gave an interesting answer to this question in Chicago when a devotee asked him, is it a mistake if you say something to someone and you're telling them the truth, but they become disturbed? Prabhupada explained that it is not a mistake if you are presenting Krishna consciousness. If you are speaking the Supreme Absolute Truth, you're always correct. He gave the example of Mother Malati's daughter, who at that time was 5 years old. She would hear in class all about the regular principles. And then when she was traveling on a train in France, she would go up to non-devotees and preach to them according to her understanding. And because she was hearing class a certain way, she would just repeat what she heard. She would tell a man, and you know what? How we live. We don't have intoxication, meat-eating, gambling, or illicit sex with women. Because he was hearing that in class all the time. Illicit sex with women. So she doesn't repeat it. So Prabhupada pointed out, that is preaching. Or she would say, do you know who Krishna is? Krishna? He's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, you might say, well, we cannot preach in that way. It's not sophisticated enough. If we went to IIT and said simply, when the students gather for the program, do you know who Krishna is? And they look at you. He's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. No, we shouldn't do that. But it's not a mistake. That was Prabhupada's point. He added that you have to become an expert snake charmer. It's not a mistake for you to present the absolute truth. Even someone doesn't take it. Because you're speaking the truth, you are correct. But as part of your service, you try to find better and better ways to administer the medicine. But the fact is, by your attempt to administer the medicine, you're not wrong. It simply means you have a whole career ahead of you, how to be a more and more expert doctor to get the patient to take the medicine. That's all. You know the examples. If your house is on fire and I scream out to you, get out of the house! Get out! The house is on fire! You fool! Leave immediately! What will you say? I don't like the way you're talking to me. I didn't appreciate the accent. And your vocabulary was not of proper choice. And what about the attitude behind your words? No. If you're intelligent, you would just be so happy someone alerted you to the fire in your house and you'd race out. You actually would thank the person. I don't mind that you were yelling at me. You told me the truth. My house is on fire. You saved me. Now, naturally, if we're interested in helping people, we'll become more and more expert at how to deliver the medicine. Still, medicine is medicine. That was Prabhupada's point. You try to give the medicine, you're always right. Nevertheless, you have a whole career ahead of you for learning how to distribute that medicine to unwilling patients in more and more conducive ways. So that is the job of a preacher. Now, Lord Rishabhdev is going to take into account the feelings of the people, the reactions of the people, as we'll discuss later. He had already spoken such powerful instructions to his son, his sons, 100 sons, instructions that we relish so much. You can speak directly, the Supreme Absolute Truth, with different styles according to the time, place, and circumstance. I'll never forget Srila Prabhupada's Australian style. He knew the Australian nature. As I was explaining to Shikshasaka and others yesterday. In Australia, the mantra or the motto is, what's in the mind comes out in the tongue. Totally the opposite from India, right? What is it here? What's in the mind never comes out of the tongue. In Australia, they pride themselves on whatever they feel they say. If they don't like you, they'll just tell you, I think you're just puffed up. Or if they like you, they'll tell you, you're really a good person. You never would be like that here. But that's their culture. So when Prabhupada went to Australia, I could see by hearing his tapes, reading his conversations, he picked up on the mood, the same message he's giving, but he styled his the way he made his points accordingly. One very nice newspaper reporter came to see Prabhupada in Melbourne. And previous to his coming, newspaper reporters had come to interview Prabhupada, and they wrote bad articles. That, you know, who are these strange people? Look at their strange ways, how they live. So this pious newspaper reporter came to see Prabhupada, and he was very respectful, very humble. And he said to Prabhupada that, I have seen these bad articles, and I'm coming here with the purpose of writing a fair, proper article. So you might think, if that happens here, that immediately you might think, well, let us glorify this reporter. Let us offer our humble obeisances to this reporter. Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming to give us good PR. So, what did Prabhupada do? No, Prabhupada saw, this man is pious, this man is submissive, I'm going to give him transcendental knowledge. I'm not going to flatter him. So, before the man could start asking questions about ISKCON, Prabhupada began to question him.
What is the goal of life?
And the man began to protest. Oh, Swami, I'm coming here to learn from you. You please tell me. You would probably all say, oh, such a humble person. Yes, he was a humble person, but that humility inspired Prabhupada to give him the absolute truth, not to flatter him. He saw this man is pious, he's submissive, therefore I will give him the ultimate knowledge, not just tell him, oh, you're a nice reporter. So, again, Prabhupada asked him,
what is the goal of life?
And the man kept protesting, you tell me, I'm coming here to learn. Because he didn't realize that he was enlivening Prabhupada more and more by his response. And so the nectar was about to descend. Finally, the man kept hesitating to answer. And then Prabhupada told him, you be guru. You tell me what is the goal of life. So then the man said, the goal of life is to find happiness within myself. That is the goal of life. Now, if someone had told you that, you would be very happy. Oh, this is a pious person. This is a spiritually in-tune person, very ripe for preaching. Yes, that was so. The reporter was very ripe for preaching. So how did Prabhupada respond? You say the goal of life is to find happiness within yourself? That is dog happiness. Is that straight? The dog is doing that. Explain, when the dog barks when you pass a dog in the street, woof, woof, the dog is finding happiness within himself. Of course, the devotees were astonished at why Prabhupada took this tack, this kind of approach. And then Prabhupada began to explain while everyone was astonished. He said, as long as you are suffering from birth, death, disease, and old age, you'll never have happiness. Therefore, the real goal in life is how to stop these miseries. Then, and only then, can you think about happiness. So in this way, he completely enlivened this man with transcendental knowledge. But he was speaking very directly. I've never heard such elsewhere. Same Prabhupada, but he packaged his delivery according to the time, place, and circumstances. So, Lord Rishabhdev's instructions, they can seem a bit intimidating, just too much. Pum sastriya mituni bhava medam. Attachment between man and woman is the basis of material existence. We wish the Supreme Lord would just leave certain subjects alone. Yes? There's some things that should not be discussed, and they should be left to our own discretion. We wish sometimes to tell Lord Vrishabhdev, look, we'll work it out our own way. We'll deal with these material desires our way. You just stay out of it. When we're ready for you, we'll let you know. Hey? Don't call us, we'll call you. But anyone who is sincerely desiring to get out of material entanglement will very much appreciate Lord Rishabhdev's direct instructions about cutting the hard knot of material existence. So, Rishabhdev has now left home, and he's been wandering throughout the world. And everywhere he goes, as you've heard, people were ridiculing him. They were throwing stones at him, even passing foul air before him. They could not appreciate his spiritual countenance. They couldn't even understand it. They just thought he was a mad person. In today's verse, you're hearing that when Lord Rishabhdev saw that the general populace was very antagonistic to his execution of mystic yoga, he accepted the behavior of a python in order to counteract their opposition. Thus he stayed in one place and lay down. While lying down, he ate and drank, and he passed stool and urine and rolled in it. Indeed, he smeared his whole body with his own stool and urine, so that the opposing elements might not come and disturb him. So this is called Ajaga Vritti, the lifestyle of a python. You'll find more extensive description of Ajaga Vritti in the seventh canto. Narada Muni explains about Prahlad Maharaj. Prahlad Maharaj and his confidential associates decided to go out for a bit of sightseeing. What is the nature of sightseeing for elevated persons? They decided to wander throughout the universe to study the nature of saintly persons. That was their sport. That was their proclivity. Let's go throughout the different planets. Let's see the various saints. Let's study them. What they were attempting to analyze is called Lokatattva. Literally, Lokatattva means knowledge of the world. But you see, you have to take things in context. That is why literal in the mundane sense, translators of Bhagavatam have trouble. And they also have trouble with Prabhupada's translations. Lokatattva, quite obvious. Loka of the world, tattva, truth. So how does, from Lokatattva, he get knowledge of saintly persons? They don't understand the depths of the Bhagavatam. And therefore they protest. This is a non-literal translation. Your Prabhupada has added so much. They don't know how to translate Bhagavatam. In fact, they're ineligible to translate Bhagavatam. Right in the beginning of Bhagavatam, all pretenders are kicked out. Dharma pujita kaitavatra paramo namatsaranam satam. Swept out. Anyone who has a motive for materialistic or speculative progress is barred access to the nectar in Bhagavatam. So, Lokatattva. Prahlad Maharaj is not interested in studying ordinary knowledge of this world, so therefore it's implicit in the context of the whole chapter that Lokatattva, what it means. It's referring to Prahlad's quest to understand the truth of the world in terms of the behavior of saintly persons. What else would Prahlad Maharaj be interested in? In the context of all the verses, that meaning is evident. Sanatana Goswami says that every syllable of Bhagavatam is saturated with pure Krishna prema. You simply have to have the eyes to see that. So, they were traveling throughout the universe, and they came upon one person who was just lying in one place. So Prahlad Maharaj decided, let me question this person. You see, by Prahlad's expert vision, he could tell by the physical structure, the physical appearance of this person lying in one place, that this is a very expert and intelligent saintly person. But Prahlad noticed, this man is so fat. How do you become fat if you're just lying in one place and not endeavoring for your material nourishment? Fatness comes when you eat opulently. Fatness comes when you have lots of money, you've endeavored financially, and you get to eat whatever you want. But Prahlad is thinking, this man is just lying here on the road. How does he have an opportunity to get so fat? So Prahlad humbly inquired. Prahlad is, as described by Narada Muni, in this section, 7th canto, he's Bhagavat Priya. He's the dearest devotee of the Lord. And he's seeing a saintly person, and he's taking the inferior position. Prahlad says, excuse me, I don't want to be impudent, but I'm just wondering how it is that you become fat. You don't endeavor materialistically, so I just politely, humbly would like to inquire. Before Prahlad Maharaj questioned like this, he paid his humble obeisances and put his head at the man's feet. This is the proper etiquette. Not that you just walk up to somebody, who are you? Why are you acting like this? Of course, even now in India, no one will do like that. But when you travel to the West, you'll see. People do like that. Just speak just without any kind of decorum, any kind of culture. Just, hey, why are you doing that? And you'll see the little kids, like you go to the USA or Australia or whatever, the little kids will just, if they see something they don't understand, they'll just come right up to you. Look, Mom, look at this person. Look at this funny person. This shows lack of culture. But in uncivilized societies, this is considered very expedient, very efficient. Just get right to the point. So, Prahlad Maharaj, he didn't do like that, of course. Although he's Bhagavat Priya, he felt himself to be inferior. So he put his head at the man's feet and then asked him questions. Why are you fat? How can you become fat just by lying in one place on the road? And then, how did the Python man reply? He glorified Prahlad Maharaj. Oh, you have Narayan in your heart to such an extent that there's no darkness. Just like when the sun rises, all the darkness goes away. Similarly, because you have Narayan in your heart to such a degree, you know everything. You know, but still you're asking. And the Python man took Prahlad Maharaj's words to be a shower of nectar. How can that be? This is expertise. Prahlad Maharaj has asked him, in a blunt, if you want to make it blunt, although he spoke so eloquently and with restraint and great reverence, if you strip his words of all decorum, Prahlad Maharaj is basically saying, why are you so fat? But because he said such a thing in such an eloquent, humble, caring, sensitive way, the Python man took his words to be a shower of nectar. And he very gladly explained his situation. One thing that apparently had baffled Prahlad Maharaj and his entourage was that by looking at the Python man, you couldn't tell where is he from. The people living in that area could not recognize, is this someone we used to know before? Is this some new person coming from some other region? No one could tell. And Prabhupada takes that opportunity to point out, it's not important, the past of a saintly person. Of course, sometimes devotees may speak of their past life in order to show persons how you can become Krishna conscious. That is different. Just like you all embarrass me. I've gotten used to it. Yeah. Every time there's a preaching engagement, this is Dev Amrita Swami. He has attended such and such university where all the presidents and CEOs come from. I used to, be embarrassed by it. Then it's always Radhanath Maharaj told me, this is just you're going to have to put up with it. This is your karma for having gone to such a place. So now I'm accustomed to it. It has value for preaching. So therefore, devotees may speak of their past life. Prabhupada would also do that sometimes in a way that would inspire us. So, other than for preaching, however, there's no need to try to understand a devotee's past life, especially a highly advanced devotee. And so with this Python man, it wasn't clear, even to the people of the area, that maybe he might be someone we used to know. We can't tell. So the Python man began to speak his autobiography, describing how he realized the futility of material enjoyment. He began to present very brilliantly Why should I endeavor for material happiness when I'm going to get whatever I'm supposed to get automatically? Therefore, I'll just stay in one place practicing Ajagavritti, the Python vow. And as I'm doing that, people may bring me opulent food. They may bring me stale food. This may come to me. That may come to me. It doesn't matter. I'm just staying in this one place because I know that all endeavors for material happiness are pointless. Whatever material happiness you're supposed to get, you're going to get even if you just stay in one place. You cannot increase your stock of material happiness in this life, nor can you decrease your stock of material distress in this life by material methods. You're going to get what you're going to get. This is hard for people to understand. What is the purpose of society today? To brainwash everyone that the more you struggle, the more you work, the more you'll have the opportunity to get money, and then the happier you'll be. We were speaking about this at, what was that school, the chemistry school? Yes. We were explaining to them the latest research, which shows that in the affluent societies, the affluent countries, where there's so much choice available in terms of consumer products, alternatives for sense gratification, people are becoming less and less happy as the number of choices increase. It's funny how the mind works. So these psychological researchers at Yale University, they discovered that if you have so many choices, like we were telling the students, it's happening in India now. When I first came to India, 77, simply had a choice, the ambassador car, yes? And when you want to make a phone call, there was just a choice between what? Fast booking, slow booking. That's it. Now you have so many cell phone companies, you know, Reliance, Airtel, which one is better? And there's so much fine print they do, you know. In the USA, people are becoming so disturbed by the cell phone companies' fine print tricks that the government had to pass a law that everything must be disclosed in big print. Because they'll say, your call costs only, 10 cents a minute. But then there's so much fine print that if the telephone call goes out of a certain district for more than a certain amount of time, then you pay a dollar a minute. So many tricks like that. So people are becoming stressed. They can't compare. This is hell for a consumer. You cannot do a proper product comparison. Then you just short circuit. You just I cannot do comparison shopping. Oh, my life is ruined. Really, that's what happens. So, because there's so many options, choices, it is not that the happiness increases. The stress increases. Because you're always thinking, I purchased this product, but maybe the other one could have been better. And it's not simply the other one. There are 10 other choices. Now, in order to feel prowess, in order to feel that you are a progressive person, you're expected to make the proper choices in consumer life at every moment. You're expected to study all the reports, the evaluations of the products. So you have to do that to justify your abilities to others. But then there's always anxiety. Maybe I should have made the other choice. I signed up to take a cruise in the Caribbean, but maybe it would have been better to use that same money to fly to Paris and enjoy. People are actually thinking like this. You may not realize it, but this is how the material mind works. You're thinking, looking from the naive devotional point of view, naive because I'm not perhaps fully understanding what or fully remembering how the materialistic mind works. You're thinking, okay, the materialist enjoyer flies to Paris from New York, enjoys the restaurants, the fine hotels, and then goes back home. No, what's going on is as the materialist enjoyer lands in Paris and enjoys the hotels and restaurants, he's thinking, is this trip as good as if I had went to the Caribbean. And I wonder what the Caribbean would be like. That's how the cheating materialistic mind works. It doesn't give you peace. So, these things, of course, are described in the Shastra, but I found it very interesting that psychological researchers are uncovering the same truth. That the more choices you have, the more possibility there is for anxiety. Oh, what about the road I could have taken? And you begin to contemplate the other possibilities, and that contemplation prevents you from enjoying the possibility that you chose. And then disappointment increases, because the more you invest in a particular choice, that means you have a greater potential for disappointment. So someone who prides themselves on, I always make the best choices. I research what I'm going to do very, very thoroughly, and then I get it. That person sets himself up for the greatest disappointment. More so than a person who's just casual. Oh, this looks good. Let me get that. I'll be happy for a while. No, that kind of person suffers less through disappointment than the mighty expert person. This is the best thing. This is what I will do. This is how I shall invest. This is how material nature works. When the inevitable problems come, the expert has more anxiety because of setting himself up on such a high perch. There's more distance to fall. Another point is that research was done on the children of affluent parents in the USA. And 50% of those children felt that their lives were more suffering than of their parents. That they had to go through a life of more hardship than their parents. And what was the reason they gave? We have so many choices. The pressure to succeed is so great. The pressure to choose the best thing is so intense that it's causing us such stress and anxiety. Therefore, our lives are worse than our parents' lives. Now, you might think, but these children are born with a silver spoon in their mouth. I remember going to very prestigious, high-pressure prep school, private boarding school in New England, in the USA. And I was a full scholarship student. So there I was amidst the sons of the DuPonts, the sons of the Kennedys, the Rockefellers. And I would be amazed to see them deride each other. Your father is filthy rich. He's worth $5 billion U.S. My father is properly situated. He's worth $500 million. They would fight like that. Yeah. They would talk behind each other's back. George Pillsbury. He's from the Pillsbury family that owns as a monopoly on the flour in the USA. Wheat flour like that. So, George Pillsbury, isn't he disgustingly rich? We heard his father. Yeah, his father is worth a couple of billion. Gosh, our family has just what it needs. Yeah, 900 million. We're humble. They would fight like that. I would be amazed. I would be totally amazed to see the anxiety they put themselves in. And when these rich kids, when it came time for Christmas vacation, they all were in anxiety. They had to, during the Christmas break, they had to pick the most trendy ski resort to go to. It had to be the one that was the current favorite. And if they, by chance, made their Christmas holidays to a ski resort that wasn't the latest fad, they would come back in complete anxiety. And the ones who had chosen the trendiest ski resort to go to, they would come back to school very proud. I went to such and such resort in Colorado.
as you all know, that is the best place right now. And the other students who didn't go to that place with, you know, and then the persons who had gone to the coolest place at the moment, they would,
oh, so you only went to Canada for your ski holidays. Don't you know? No one goes there anymore. It's so inferior. And the other students would actually feel in great anxiety, like, oh, my whole vacation was a failure. I didn't choose the right ski resort. Really, I saw this with my own eyes. I couldn't believe it. They could not enjoy, even though they had so much money. Their minds were cheating them. They don't understand the power of the mind to cheat. So our presentation at this school, what was it again? Yes. It was entitled The Power of the Mind. So I began explaining the power of the mind to delude you. Even though you have so much affluence, so many choices available, your mind cheats you even more. In other words, if you're smart, you'll understand life is meant to be lived simply. But this point is not understood. Recent research from Harvard University shows that the mind of the average person has the tendency to always overestimate the happiness that a certain thing will bring. And it has the tendency to always underestimate the distress that a certain thing will bring. Of course, we know the Shastra tells us that all the time, but it's interesting. There's psychological research to support this. People constantly think that a material experience is going to give me so much happiness, and they always overshoot the mark. They always think it will be much more than what they actually get. And they always underestimate the distress. This is how the mind cheats you. It's very, very interesting how the simpler your life is, the more happy you'll actually be. This is not anymore just some kind of sentimental slogan. It's actually now being brought out by scientific research. And of course, I always present to them the knowledge of the World Values Survey. This is a global survey taken by scholars from around the world to evaluate what country is the happiest. And they make a list of rankings. And the word must have gotten out in India, because I see quite a few students there. They know what the results were a few years ago. That from the standards of the materialists themselves, not the devotees, we didn't make this survey, it's the materialists, according to material criteria. Based on those materialistic standards, the happiest country in the world was the poorest country, Bangladesh. And all the big affluent societies, USA, Germany, England, whatever, they're like 15, 16, 17, 18 on the list. So by their very research, by the research of the materialists, they're showing that their endeavors are futile. It's something to think about. I was explaining this point at IIT yesterday, and as I was explaining that point, I could see the pride of the engineers. I am an engineer. I, by my brilliance, will create more prosperity. I'll create more ease and affluence for the people. So it's very hard for them to hear that your endeavors are not increasing the happiness. So then I think Shyamananda told me, once they realize that, they have another position to retreat to. Well, anyway, regardless of what people do with the technology we give them, we're just into pure research. The people can do what they like with what we give them. We're just into the research. So Shyamananda was telling me, it's just like the motto of the American Rifle Association. It's one of the most powerful political agitating groups in the USA. They're always working to protect the sacred right of every American to have a weapon in the home.
It's very essential to be an American. You have to have a weapon. So, their motto is, guns don't kill people. People do. No, don't blame the gun. Blame the people. Don't try to restrict gun use. Don't try to restrict the possession of guns. The guns aren't at fault. It's the people. Therefore, let everyone have a gun. It all makes sense. So, Shyamananda Guru was explaining, this is the position that the engineers will retreat to. Okay, okay. So, you're saying that all our innovations that we're giving to society are not producing happiness. All right, that may be true. But anyway, it's not our problem. We're just into pure research. This is, of course, completely irresponsible. It's a way of putting blinders on and avoiding to see the consequences of what you're doing. Now, how is it that the more affluence is there, the less happiness is there? Psychologists are starting to question what's going on. What is truly happening? And then the researchers have brought out a point that they call adaptation. We'll call it chapala sukha, flickering happiness. They have to put a more fancy name on it, adaptation. That when you make your choice, the example given that you as an affluent person decide, I am going to get this kind of Mercedes instead of this kind of BMW. You fix your mind on this luxury car, you get it, and as you're riding in it, you feel the satisfaction, but soon the adaptation takes over. The product loses its charm. And very soon you begin to think, maybe there's a different car I should have had. Maybe I should have had a Rolls Royce. So the honeymoon is very short-lived before the materialistic mind starts to cheat you again. Is this really the best car you could have gotten? Are you sure? The same thing is there, of course, in materialistic relationships. Someone marries. We're speaking about materialistic marriage. And they expect, I'm going to be satisfied with this person for the rest of my life. This is it. We've lived together for 5 years, Western style. Now we're going to have a marriage and the bride will wear white. Purity. Even if there's already a child born, that's okay. Now we're going to decide to marry and we're going to live happily ever after. Very quickly the charm goes away. Very quickly the mind starts to calculate. Why should I stay with this person when there's so many other potential partners out there? This is the nature of material existence. So the Python man had already figured this out. You can read in his slokas how he brilliantly explains the workings of the material energy. And his conclusion was, because Maya works like this, I've got nothing to do with it. I'm just going to lay here on the road. Whatever comes my way, comes my way. Earlier in the seventh canto, Prahlad Maharaj had given the same information in a nutshell. Sukham indriyakam daicha deha yogena dehinam. Sarvacha labhyate daivat yata dukham ayatnata. Your distress comes automatically. Similarly, your happiness will come automatically. Why endeavor for happiness when you're going to get what you're supposed to get anyway? Very hard point for materialists to understand. Very difficult point. What do you mean? How is it that you don't endeavor for happiness and you're going to get what you're going to get anyway? The mode of passion, Rajagun will not allow them to sit tight and appreciate this point. Not possible. Because the lust that surcharges society is so great, you have to endeavor. That Rajagun is boiling in your veins. I have abilities. There's pride. I have abilities, I have expertise, I've been educated. The world is there for me to show my prowess. I'll get more You may get more money, but you won't get more happiness. That is the distinction. People don't understand this point, though. You can get more possessions, but you won't get more material happiness. It is your material happiness that's predestined. So what if your income goes up? It doesn't mean your happiness will go up. Your happiness that you're going to get is based on your past life. That is the point. But it's too subtle for brains cooked in Rajagun to understand. It takes a lot of deep thought. Basically, you have to be in Sattvagun to grasp these points. So, Lord Rishabhdev, he's demonstrating the behavior of a python. He says, no more traveling around. People are just ridiculing me. They're throwing things at me. Not that it disturbed Lord Rishabhdev, but he just decided that this is not what I want to happen. These people are so antagonistic to the execution of my mystic yoga. Therefore, to stop their opposition, I'll take the behavior of a python. I'll just lay in one place. I'll smear my body with stool and urine. In this way, the public will not disturb me. Now, later, in the coming verses, you're going to hear that in this way, Lord Rishabhdev cheated the people. In other words, he prevented them from understanding his true spiritual glories because they weren't ready for it. This point is explained in Bhagavad Gita by Lord Krishna. Naham prakasha sarvasya yoga maya samavrata. Krishna says, I don't freely expose myself to everyone. I keep myself covered by a curtain. Any respectable gentleman or lady will do like that. It's not that any strange person can walk up to you on the street and say, who are you? Tell me all about your life. You would think the person is crazy. Discretion is always there in the life of a gentleman and lady. And Krishna is the supreme dignified person. Therefore, he doesn't allow persons who have antagonistic motives to understand him. He has this curtain of illusory energy. And that curtain of illusory energy cheats people. It prevents them from seeing the true glories of the Lord. Queen Kunti talks about this in her famous prayers. Maya javani katshanyam adyarokshadam avyam na lakshase mudha drisha. The mudhas, the fools, can't see through the curtain of Maya. They don't recognize Krishna behind everything, just like someone can't recognize the true identity of an actor. So Lord Rishabhdev, in this way, cheated the people. You're not ready to appreciate me as I am? I won't show you who I really am. So in this way, there are so many things we can learn from Lord Rishabhdev's teachings. We can think about these teachings constantly, and in this way we'll be protected from the illusory energy. Whenever you do the preaching, going out in the world, feel your mind a little affected by the attacks of the illusory energy, you can just quickly read Lord Rishabhdev's teachings, and you'll notice immediately the cloud of illusion dissipates. Any questions? Yes.
Hare Krishna. Maharaj, you were speaking about to understand the concepts, this kind of concepts you were talking about, requires Sattva Guna. You were especially in that talking about the Chapal Sukh and adaptation and everything. And in that you were concluding that it's very hard for materialists to accept or grasp these truths. Because it requires some kind of sattva guna. Because people are in rajoguna, so they will not understand. So I have a question that most of the society is actually, including myself, are in rajoguna and tamoguna platform. So how we are going to inject these concepts in the seminars which we conduct outside, and we tell about these things. And even the psychologist, psychiatrist, they are coming out with these concepts. But people will just appreciate, or they may not appreciate also. So what kind of things we are going to give them actually in preaching to the newcomers, I'm asking?
When a devotee speaks transcendental knowledge, it affects the heart. At our programs, you proceed the speaking with some kirtan, and then you speak Bhagavad Katha, packaged in a way that is suitable for the time, place, and circumstance, but still the basic kernel of transcendental knowledge is the same. And because of the sincerity of the devotee, what he says affects the hearts of the listeners. Because of your sincerity, the super soul in the heart of the person who's listening tells the person, listen to what he's saying. It's not just you, there's also the super soul. So according to your purity, the super soul will assist you accordingly. But then Krishna is independent. Krishna can do whatever he likes. Srila Prabhupada gave the example that sometimes there's what's called a sun shower. Even though there's complete bright sky, the sun in the sky, no clouds, rain comes. Does it happen in Mumbai sometimes? Yes. So, in other words, there's no cause visible for rain, but still rain comes. So, Srila Prabhupada used that natural phenomenon to explain that sometimes the person has no desire to be Krishna conscious. And even the devotee who's trying to impress that person who has no desire, that devotee is not a very good devotee at all. No potency. But still, the Lord, independently in the heart, can decide to direct this person, become Krishna conscious. Just like sometimes, even though there's no rain clouds in the sky, rain comes. Because the Lord is independent. But generally, the way it works is, yayatamam prapadyate, tamsatai vajamiham. Because of the sincerity of the preacher, because of some possible sincerity of the person you're preaching to, the super soul arranges things. It's very fascinating. This is what makes preaching exciting. Sometimes you just don't know what's going to happen. You think you've got it all figured out. This person is a good candidate. This person's a bad candidate. Of course, you're supposed to use your intelligence as far as it goes, but you must always remember that your intelligence is limited. Krishna can always provide the surprises. You can study Prabhupada's prayers, Markine Bhagavad Dharma. He expresses what you're asking as he's on the Jaladuta, approaching his destination. How will these people ever be Krishna conscious? But I know if they hear the message of Bhagavatam, their hearts will be cleansed. So that's why you all are going out night after night, universities, here, there, everywhere. You're injecting the message of Bhagavatam, which will act. Because you're hearing Bhagavatam in disciplic succession. When you deliver the Bhagavatam, it affects the hearts. Anything else? All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Glory to Prabhupada.